and we'll take that under advisement and move to the eighth case, Stark versus Estrue. And Mr. Duncan, and I think we have you for the next case as well, don't we?
Yes, we do. You do.
So you don't have to move.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Dana Duncan, counsel for Mr. Stark. The central issue in this case is the issue involving vocational expert testimony. There is a secondary issue in regards to the fibromyalgia diagnosis, but the central case, or the central point of the case, rests on the vocational testimony. The term vocational expert, sometimes in the annals of Social Security law, is rather a misnomer. In this particular case, the vocational expert testified to the fact that there were available jobs of sedentary production inspector, clerk, and examiner, sedentary hand packager, and sedentary general office helper. In these particular cases, vocational experts are to rely upon the Dictionary of Occupational Titles in establishing the existence of jobs. These are not occupations that are in the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, but are instead broad categories that could encompass multiple issues. In a Social Security disability hearing, the last two issues obviously involve the availability of the claimant's ability to perform past relevant work, and on the fifth step, the burden shifts to the claimant at step five. Vocational experts are oftentimes called, as in this case, at step five, but they provide only three functions. One, to specify occupations. Two, the to provide the exertional and non-exertional components of the occupation. And three, to state the number of available jobs in the national economy. What has been going on in the Seventh Circuit is that the commissioner has raised arguments that this issue was waived by trial counsel's failure to question these occupations or to raise them. But a little bit of history involved here. The Seventh Circuit created the Donahue decision. In that case, it addressed specifically the issues involved in vocational testimony. The court in that ruled that the ALJ may rely on the bottom line testimony unless the claimant challenges the foundation of that testimony. It's a case cited by the commissioner. However, the heart of the case was the desire of the court to create some consistency in expert testimony from vocational experts. The concept was best articulated by the court in Donahue when it stated, but the idea that experts should use reliable methods does not depend on Rule 702 alone. It plays a role in the administrative process because every decision must be supported by substantial evidence. Evidence is not substantial if vital testimony has been conjured or out of whole cloth. From Donahue, it was clear that vocational testimony was to be reliable, and if it was not substantial evidence by which the commissioner could rely to satisfy their burden of proof at step five.
Well, are you arguing that there were no jobs available in the national economy that this fellow could do?
No, Judge, what I'm arguing is that this individual, it's not clear. The commissioner has the burden of proof of establishing that these jobs exist. Unfortunately,
well, you're arguing basically the procedure was wrong, but I'm asking you, did that have any impact on this guy's case?
It would in this particular case because even though the commissioner was able to cite numerous jobs that may apply, we're unclear, without having to obtain another vocational report, how many jobs in those categories. Commissioner cited several, but I also cited multiple cases where the vocational expert, using those categories that he testified to, were light occupations. If the ALJ, or excuse me, if the VE at the hearing was using the same occupations that I had in order to arrive at his numbers, then there were no jobs available because the occupations I cited in my brief were all light, and the ALJ residual functional capacity assessment was for sedentary. So all those jobs would have exceeded his abilities to perform. So without anything further, we don't know. It may be that a different vocational expert or the same vocational expert could very well find jobs, but under those particular ones,
well, you're not making the argument that the jobs don't exist, though. That's my
No. What I'm saying is that there is a procedural issue, and that is that.
Well, of course, the ALJ asked him, "Is your testimony in accord with the manual?"
Correct.
And he said yes.
Yeah, and that's become.
The question is, what's the next question, or should there be a next question? Is there a requirement for a next question?
I think there is, Judge, and this is why the ALJs in these cases, and I do probably 100 hearings a year, use these as a get out of jail free card. They just ask that question as a throw in, and then use that to rely upon. The ruling specifically says is that you are to ask, and the Prochaska case specifically says you are to ask. But then it says the next step is you are to also resolve all apparent conflicts. And in this particular case, the ALJ in this hearing was a very experienced administrative law judge who's very familiar with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles and Vocational Testimony. And it would have been apparent to him that these broad categories, hand packager, for instance, could encompass multiple occupations. At the very least, he was under a duty to look into this and to at least ask the next question of, well, do those correspond with the Dictionary of Occupational Titles? And if not, why? Why have you deviated from the Dictionary of Occupational Titles? It's not like it's a draconian measure to require these judges to ask two or three more questions to ferret this out. The commissioner keeps arguing that if you don't ask, or if the applicant does not ask these questions, then it's waived. That is not the case because the burden under SSR 004P rests with the commissioner and the administrative law judge. Prochaska says that. So it can't be waived simply on that issue.
Counsel, may I ask you something?
Yes.
Is there anything in the evidence establishing that this man, with the illness that he has been found to be suffered from it, a primary paralgia? Isn't the evidence is that he has something similar to it?
Correct.
So is the illness that you are relying on found within the scope of eligibility?
There is no requirement that fibromyalgia be found to even be a severe impairment because the court has ruled many times that you are to take into account not just severe impairments but also non-severe impairments and consider the entire scope of the impact upon everything. And in this particular case...
Well, did the administrative law judge find that he or she is entitled to it in this case?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, is there any testimony that the party is entitled to it in this case?
Well, in this particular case, if the given...
No, just the answer is yes or no. Is there any direct evidence?
If you apply the treating physician's report...
Who is the treating physician?
Dr.
Hildebrand?
Yes.
Well, she wasn't found to be, was she?
Well, in order for this case to have a situation where he would be entitled to benefits, given his age, education, and work experience and the residual functional capacity, you would have to have some degree of testimony from a vocational expert at step
didn't
five
she
to establish
only,
it.
Didn't she only fill out the application for him? And did she actually treat him, or did he?
It's
yes or no.
That is not a point.
Pardon me?
It's not a yes or no answer. And this, I didn't handle the case at the trial or at the hearing level. All I know is that she filled it out. The finding of the judge was that she did not treat But that's no different than a state agency physician who fills out their paperwork.
But that's what's before us.
But it's, again, the fact that ALJ relies just as much on cases in, from the findings of the state agency who never examine, let alone see.
But those are ones who are called in to examine the medical reports.
Correct.
That have already been made from qualified experts.
Correct. In this case, Dr. Hildebrand at least would have had the record available to review before she completed the report.
But is there any testimony that she reviewed it?
She puts it or put it on her questionnaire that she had reviewed and
or was it
completed.
That is it on the questionnaire that she interviewed this party and filled out what he stated?
Well, I think that's going a little far to say that a doctor would just automatically repeat whatever the claimant says without at least reviewing the medical evidence.
Well, she was filling out his application. That's what she would have to put down, what he told her or she told him. Whatever the party may be.
To some extent, because that is part of the whole consideration. I mean, you can't have a medical history without some sort of verbalization by the patient. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Sanu?
May it please the Court? My name is Mary Seno, and I represent the Commissioner of Social Security. The ALJ in this case was not using Social Security Ruling 004P as a get-out-of-jail-free card. 004P requires an ALJ to ascertain whether there are conflicts between a vocational expert's testimony and the information contained in the DOT. If there is a conflict, the ALJ must conduct additional inquiry and obtain a reasonable explanation for the conflict and resolve that conflict on the record before relying on the vocational expert testimony. In this case, the ALJ never got to the second step because no conflict was identified. The ALJ asked the...
This is a big mystery to me, frankly. If there's not a correspondence between the categories in the dictionary and the categories to which he testified, I don't know if that's a conflict, but it certainly is a discontinuity or something or other. And I wonder what ought to be done about it.
Well, one of the jobs that the vocational expert testified to was assembler. Now, there is a job title in the vocational, in the DOT called assembler, and I think we mentioned that in our brief. And then there are also various types of assemblers. Some of those are, don't have my list with me, I'm sorry, but slide zip assembler and several other types of assemblers that all fall within the sedentary category. The other jobs, such as inspector, examiner, checker, are not listed as inspector, examiner, and checker, but are more specific. And so there may be some incongruity there, as Your Honor points out, yet it's not as if they don't exist. The DOT contains specific occupational titles with very specific information that the vocational expert in this case may have given titles in broader groups doesn't bring his testimony clearly into conflict with the DOT. There is a lot of information that vocational experts testify to in Social Security hearings that is not contained in the DOT. For example, the DOT doesn't contain job numbers. The DOT also doesn't contain other information about specific jobs. And Social Security Ruling 004P points out that the agency recognizes that the DOT contains information about most, but not all, occupations. It's the result of comprehensive studies, and the occupations are described as a collective description of numerous jobs. It is not an exhaustive source of information about a particular occupation's requirements. In this case, nothing about the jobs identified would have raised a red flag that would have warned the ALJ that they were patently in conflict with the RFC description that he provided in the hypothetical question. And that's why we don't believe that there's any conflict in this case.
You're saying the differences are just semantic, is that it?
Yes. At the hearing, as we pointed out, nothing in the vocational expert's testimony suggested that there was any potential conflict between the jobs he identified and the information contained in the DOT. Additionally, at the hearing, Mr. Stark's counsel did not give any indication that he believed a conflict existed. He didn't challenge the vocational expert as to the basis of his testimony. He didn't challenge the vocational expert's qualifications either. And I would like to just point out for a moment that the term vocational expert is not a misnomer, and it's certainly not a misnomer in this case. In this case, we have a vocational expert who has a master's degree in vocational rehabilitation. He also worked with numerous agencies in various capacities. He's been a vocational expert for the Social Security Administration for over 10 years, and he has worked placing clients who suffered industrial accidents in light and sedentary jobs, the very types of jobs that are at issue in this case. Moving on, though.
No, but it seems to me that controversy here is that whether this is the ALJ job or we should rely on the lawyer for the applicant. You're saying you can rely on the lawyer for this purpose.
Your
opponent says no, it ought to be the ALJ.
We're saying in this case that it's the ALJ's job. We don't dispute that it's the ALJ's job to ask the vocational expert and obtain the information. When there's no cue in the record for the ALJ to identify a conflict, another cue is the inaction of plaintiff's counsel. We're not arguing that he waived his rights under 004P, but what we are arguing is if a conflict was so patently obvious that the ALJ should have seen it when he heard the testimony, there was counsel there, too, who could have said, here's an obvious conflict, we need to resolve it, and pointed it out for the ALJ. That didn't happen in this case.
May I ask you, is he entitled to Social Security benefits with his illness, alleged illness?
No. If you're asking about the fibromyalgia and
yes.
the other injuries that he suffered, no. As far as the fibromyalgia that is discussed in this record, there are three references to fibromyalgia. The first reference comes from a nurse who's not considered an acceptable medical source for the purpose of treating physicians in the Social Security regulations. She mentioned that he may have fibromyalgia.
May have. Right.
She didn't assert that she had conducted any testing or give any reasons why he may have fibromyalgia, except that he's complaining of generalized muscle pain. 6 months later, in January of 2002, Mr. Stark reported to Dr. Gowing, who did some tests and discovered that he tested positive for Lyme disease. Now, at that point, Dr. Gowing treated Mr. Stark for Lyme disease, but he also noted that Mr. Stark's symptoms could be caused by fibromyalgia. But if they were caused by fibromyalgia, they would not respond to the treatment that he was providing. The next reference in the record is from Dr. Hildebrand in July of 2002. And as Your Honor pointed out earlier, it's not even clear whether Dr. Hildebrand examined Mr. Stark or whether she was just reiterating the other information in the record, but she certainly she repeats Dr. Gowing's statement about fibromyalgia verbatim. So her statement suggests that she didn't come to that conclusion on her own. Neither of those physicians diagnosed fibromyalgia. They talked about it as a possibility, and they talked about it because he had fatigue and generalized muscle complaints. There are other symptoms of fibromyalgia that this court has recognized, such as 11 of 18 tender points that, when pressed firmly, cause a claimant to flinch. Those were never documented in the record. And after July of 2002, Mr. Stark never complained of musculoskeletal type complaints or fatigue. Therefore, the ALJ's reference to the fact that the nurse noted that he may have fibromyalgia accurately reflects the discussion of fibromyalgia in this case, and he wasn't really required to do anything more with that. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Snow. How much time does Mr. Duncan have left? You could have another minute because of the amount of questioning we had.
Thank you, Your Honor. In answer to the question of Mr. Stark's condition, my brief makes note of the fact that the July 26, 2002 examination by Dr. Hildebrand notes that she did an examination and said that there was a 50% loss of range of motion of the lumbar spine on extension and flexion, 15% of normal lateral flexion, and 25% of normal rotation. Her report does not seem to limit her to the issue of fibromyalgia. It includes it, and it should have been a factor that should have been considered in evaluating the case, but it is not the primary factor. The commissioner wants you to believe that that the issue can just go away because there's no apparent conflict. If you read SSR 00-4P, the second question says, if the VE or VS evidence appears to conflict with the DOT, the adjudicator will obtain a reasonable explanation for the apparent conflict. It doesn't state if the VE says there's a conflict, then you inquire. It says whether the evidence does. That connotes, if you apply any kind of statutory construction, that connotes that there is a duty to make a further inquiry and examine the evidence beyond the simple initial inquiry. And that's what it means, and it should be no different than Prochaska. The burden rests with the commissioner on that point.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Duncan. And that case will be